2002 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session number 362, America's War Against Terrorism, One Latter-day Saint's Perspective, a paper presented by Robert A. Reese, with a response by Brian Richards.
Please turn off your cell phones or turn to vibrate or whatever so we don't hear them. We appreciate that. My name is Sue Bergen, and I'm going to introduce our presenter and responder. Our presenter is Bob, or Robert Reese. I've known Bob since I was 3 years old. Well, he's known me since I was 3 years old, maybe we should put it that way. A dear friend. He lived in Los Angeles for many years and was an English professor and director of UCLA's Extension Arts program there. He's now living in Brookdale, California, which is near a tiny, charming little town near Santa Cruz. He's director of education and humanities for the Institute of Heart Math there. If you don't know what that is, look it up on the internet. It's a fascinating institute because the research they're doing now. And our responder is Brian Richards. Brian is a writer and aerospace consultant in Provo. He has a BS in mechanical engineering from BYU. And he has written recently this book, Triopia and the Burden of Excess. This is on for sale downstairs. And it's loosely based on Richards' own semester abroad in Jerusalem, an experience that helped him to vividly portray the culture and scenography of the land that is holy to three separate religions. Although it was written long before September 11th, the book's exploration of the conflicts between these religions and thoughts about the individual's place in the face of dogma are keenly relevant. That's from Wild Violet Literary Magazine. We'll turn the time over to Bob and Brian.
Thank you, Sue. It's a particular pleasure to be introduced by my dear friend. I want to say at the beginning that I want in my remarks today to let you know that I am respectful of alternative points of view. I don't present these thoughts. I hope I don't present them dogmatically, and I hope there's some time for discussion. I begin with two quotes, one from the poet Carolyn Porche. It is either the beginning or the end of the world, and the choice is ourselves or nothing. The second quote is from the 46th Psalm. God makes wars to cease unto the ends of the earth. Ever since the dark hours of September 11th, I've been disquieted about what has come to be called the war on terrorism. While I understand and share the moral outrage over the barbaric attacks on our nation and its people, I have felt uneasy about the quick polarizing rhetoric and the boasting of our power and what we are going to do to the perpetrators of the suicide attacks against the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, about the clamoring calls for revenge and retribution, and about the military force we have unleashed upon far countries. I have wondered quietly to myself if there weren't some better alternatives than to launch an all-out assault on a country that had already been bombed back into the Stone Age and to undertake a mission so seemingly impossible as to eradicate terror from off the face of the earth, if not from the hearts of its inhabitants. One of the problems with declaring war against terrorism is that it is really impossible to win a war against a military tactic, any more than one could win a war against an attitude or a belief. One might as well declare war on boredom or espionage. Another problem, insurmountable it seems to me, is that there is no universal agreement as to what constitutes terrorism. Like beauty, it is in the eye of the beholder. If we call what happened in New York and Washington on September 11th terrorism, as I believe we must, do we also count as terror the atrocities our government committed in undermining democratic processes in Chile, Guatemala, and El Salvador, to name only those examples in Central and South America that come easily to mind? As we are learning from the tenuous alliance that President Bush has put together since September 11th, one country's freedom fighters are another country's terrorists. What this means is that anyone can define terrorism on a basis that suits the expediency of the moment. We considered Osama bin Laden a freedom fighter
when the CIA trained him and a number of other Muslims in terrorist tactics when we were using them to help defeat the Russians in Afghanistan. Ironically, he used the tactics he had been taught against his teachers. Another example of our, what seems to me, the difficulty of defining terrorism and fighting against it is our inconsistent policy. We, both North Korea and China, have nuclear weapons programs, and both export missiles to Iran and Pakistan, yet one is part of the axis of evil and the other is our friend in the war against terrorism. A further example of our inconsistency with regard to terrorism is our sending American troops to the Philippines to fight Islamic terrorists. As Nicholas Kristof has said, we are unwittingly about to join a dirty war in Basilan, siding with murderers and torturers, that is, the Philippine army, in a way that dishonors our larger purposes. To go ahead with joint military exercises on Basilan would risk our most valuable possession in the war on terror, our integrity, by adding American firepower and troops to an operation that is brutally out of control. One of the most egregious examples of our inconsistency on terrorism was our longtime support for one of America's most notorious terrorists, Jonas Savimbi, the Angolan rebel leader who was recently killed. As Nicholas Kristof declared in an article in the New York Times titled "Our Own Terrorist," Savimbi murdered and tortured countless civilians over the years. The Angolan civil war that he sustained may be responsible for 500,000 deaths since 1975. Kristof adds, "But he was our warlord, not the other side's, and so we were blind to his brutality, as the Saudis and Pakistanis are to the sins of their terrorists." The contrast between these two, the contrast in terms of how one sees terrorism, is seen in two points of view on Savimbi. One was Ronald Reagan's, who called Savimbi the Angola's Abraham Lincoln. The other was the African specialist Maku Muta, whose description of him as Africa's classical terrorist suggests how subjective the definition of terrorism can be. Nowhere is our inconsistency on terrorism more evident than in our relations with Saudi Arabia, our longtime ally in the Middle East and home to 15 of the 19 hijackers who killed over 3,000 American civilians on their suicide missions. Even though the Saudi royal family has created economic and social conditions that breed terrorism, even though a number of Saudi organizations fund Islamic terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda, and even though the Saudi government funds hundreds of madrasa schools across the Islamic world, which trains hundreds of thousands of young men to hate America, because of its oil, Saudi Arabia is seen as a partner in the war on terrorism. Oil and arms may also explain why, last August, following years of business dealing between Presidents Bush Sr. and Jr., and members of the bin Laden family, President George W. Bush, much to the dismay of the FBI, called off investigations of Osama bin Laden's brothers, Omar and Abdullah, and WAMY, a charity suspected by the FBI of funding terrorism. As Gregory Palast of the BBC reported, the government wanted to keep pro-American Saudi royal family out of control of the world's biggest oil spigot, in control of the world's biggest oil spigot, even at the price of turning a blind eye to any terrorist connection. The fact of the matter is we can't win such a war, especially as we are presently waging it, for the more aggressively we pursue terrorists within our own borders and around the world, the more we nourish the ground out of which terrorism grows. Those who see the United States as the great Satan, as a country of infidels whom Allah has commissioned them to destroy, are only confirmed in their hatred and in their determination by any aggressive acts we take to destroy them. As the Algerian writer Mohamed Moussalohu observes, the war is lost if the West plays the game of the fundamentalists, which is violence, because you cannot frighten someone who accepts death with devotion. Last spring, the administration spoke of having achieved most of the objectives in Afghanistan, but as recent events have shown, the jury is still clearly out on this matter. Consider the following. Tens of thousands of Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers are presently unaccounted for. Many of these apparently slipped over the border into Pakistan or other countries. Others, protected by former friends, have regrouped in the mountains of Afghanistan and currently are engaged in pitched battles with Afghan and UN troops. Next, U.S. intelligence agencies estimate that there are al-Qaeda cells in at least 60 countries worldwide, including our own, and that they have sophisticated methods of communicating with one another. Warlords reviving ancient enmities are fighting one another and resisting the authority of the fragile UN-sponsored central government. According to a report in the New York Times, quote, the Central Intelligence Agency has warned in a classified report that Afghanistan could once again fall into violent chaos if steps are not taken to restrain the competition for power among rival warlords and to control ethnic tensions. It is important to remember that the majority of the Afghan people welcomed the Taliban as a lesser evil than the warlords. Tribal loyalties sealed by blood for centuries will not easily or quickly be turned to support a central bureaucracy. Resentment continues to build among civilians, many of whom have inadvertently been killed and wounded by American armaments. According to William Arkin, Human Rights Watch advisor and a member of the faculty at the U.S. Air Force's School of Advanced Air Power, we've got about 300 incidents in our database, and I'd say about a third involve some civilian casualties. Osama bin Laden, the mastermind behind the September 11th attacks, and the primary objective of our incursion into Afghanistan and many of their top al-Qaeda operatives have yet to be accounted for. Faced with such facts, we have to ask ourselves if there is no better way than the one we are currently pursuing. Where can we turn to find a better way? In times of peril and danger, we are instructed to turn to the scriptures and to the teachings of the prophets. What do these teach us about war? While the scriptures taken as a whole admonish us to choose peace over war, perhaps the clearest message on this subject is found in the Doctrine and Covenants. As a prelude to his position on war, the Lord said to the prophet Joseph Smith, quote, I give unto you a commandment, that you shall forsake all evil and cleave unto all good, that you shall live by every word which proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. To emphasize what he considers all evil and all good, the Lord then goes on to say, I will prove you in all things whether you shall abide in my covenant. Therefore, renounce war and proclaim peace, and seek diligently to turn the hearts of the children to their fathers and the hearts of their fathers to the children. As Hugh Nibley observes, renounce is a strong word. We are not to try to win peace by war, or as Gore Vidal's most recent book is, Waging Perpetual War to Gain Perpetual Peace. We are not to try to win peace by war or merely to call a truce, but to renounce war itself, to disdain it as a policy, while proclaiming peace without reservation. What this scripture means, I believe, is that one of the ways in which the Lord is proving or testing us is whether we actually renounce war and proclaim peace. There also seems to be a direct connection between these two actions, and I think both renouncing war and proclaiming peace are necessary, and the intergenerational turning of hearts to one another. Since the turning of such hearts is the key to vicarious participatory redemption in the temples, this scripture seems to imply that our refusal to renounce war and proclaim peace may hinder such work. But it also hinders the turning of the hearts of living fathers and mothers and their children to one another, as I believe it certainly did during the Vietnam War. Two brief personal anecdotes. Two of the more painful experiences I had in the church had to do with the Vietnam War. I belonged to a study group of Latter-day Saints in the Westwood First Ward during that war, and we met monthly to talk about things that were happening in various parts of the world. And when it came time for my wife and me to teach the lesson, it happened to be in Vietnam. And this was right at the height of the war, and we had become by that time anti-war activists. And you would have thought from the other 20 Latter-day Saints in that study group that we were guilty of killing prophets or proclaiming some tremendous heresy. I mean, I've never felt so assaulted as I was on that day. And then not too much longer after that, I was teaching a gospel doctrine class and decided that on this particular Sunday I would use materials that the Quakers had put out on the armaments that we were using in Vietnam, which were killing and injuring civilians. And that didn't go very well either. According to the scriptures, how are we to regard those who use terrorist attacks against us? Christ's teaching on this matter are, to my mind, straightforward and unambiguous. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. He makes it clear that calling ourselves Christians is dependent upon such an attitude, for he adds that we must behave this way, that is, in order that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sendeth rain on the just and the unjust. In other words, if God blesses those whom we consider our enemies, then he expects us to do no less. Further, we cannot lay claim to being his children unless we act in this way. Why is this the case? Because I believe God, who knows each of us intimately, and who counts our individual souls as being of infinite worth, knows that redemption does not come by revenge or retribution, but rather by love and sacrifice. It is the lesson that humankind has refused to learn through the ages, and for which it still pays an enormous price. The Lord hopes for the redemption of all of his children, and he knows that when we seek revenge and retribution, it cankers our souls, as well as wreaking destruction on those against whom our hatred is aimed, thus denying them a greater opportunity to find redemption because we lock them into a cycle of violence. While one could argue that they too have choice in the matter, we must remember that as children of the light, we have the greater responsibility both to stop the violence and let love work its redemptive power. Some would argue that Jesus didn't really mean that we should love our enemies, that we should turn the other cheek, or that we should forgive others That this is an ideal ethic, by which we aren't expected to live. This is the argument made by one Plotinus Plinlimon, a character in Melville's novel Pierre. Plinlimon argues that God doesn't really expect us to abide by such a higher law, that, quote, the highest abstract heavenly righteousness is not only impossible, but would be entirely out of place and positively wrong in a world like this. He adds, in things terrestrial, a man must not be governed by things celestial. He must by no means make a complete unconditional sacrifice of himself on behalf of any other being or cause or any conceit. I'm afraid that the majority of humankind share Plinlimon's sentiments. That is because they most likely do not understand what Jesus was saying when he taught such principles. Most interpret this teaching as passive nonviolence. But as Walter Wink suggests, Jesus was being both more subtle and more subversive than this. As Wink says, Jesus clearly rejected the military option as a way to redress Jewish grievances. He refused to lead troops in war against Rome or to defend his own cause by violent means. He endured the cross rather than prove false to his own nonviolent way. Through the history of his people's violent and nonviolent struggle for survival, Jesus discovered a way of opposing evil without becoming evil in the process. Here at last was a full-blown alternative to the politics of quote-unquote redemptive violence. Wink suggests that what Jesus was really teaching was a third way, a way between violence and total submission to evil. Although, as the anti-Lehi Nephites in the Book of Mormon demonstrated, that too at times has proved more powerful than violence. Wink argues that instead of teaching non-resistance to evil, Jesus is telling us, quote, to refuse to oppose it on its own terms. He is urging us to transcend both passivity and violence by finding a third way, one that is at once assertive and nonviolent. Wink then shows how three of Jesus' otherwise perplexing commands, turn the other cheek, to give a person who sues you not only his cloak but your coat as well, and to walk not 1 mile but two, are really meant not to be passive acts but nonviolently subversive ones. He argues, for example, that in the story of a rich man taking a poor person to court and humiliating him by asking for his cloak, if the person being sued gave all of his clothing, also his coat, to the one suing him, he would stand naked before the court. As Wink observes, nakedness was taboo in Judaism, and shame fell less on the naked party than on the person viewing or causing the nakedness. By stripping, the debtor has brought shame on the creditor. the poor man has transcended this attempt to humiliate him. He has risen above shame. At the same time, he has registered a stunning protest against the system that created this debt. The result of such an action, Wink says, is dramatic. Imagine the debtor leaving the court naked. His friends and neighbors, aghast, inquire what happened. He explains, they join a growing procession which now resembles a victory parade. This is guerrilla theater. The entire system by which debtors are oppressed has been publicly unmasked. The creditor is revealed to be not a legitimate moneylender, but a party to the reduction of an entire social class to landlessness and destitution. This unmasking is not simply punitive, since it offers the creditor a chance to see, perhaps for the first time in his life, what his practices cause, and to repent. How different this is from our present strategy, and the results are what one might expect. It is important to note at first that Osama bin Laden has accomplished the two things he most desired. He has humiliated the richest, most powerful nation in the world, and he has used the simplest of household weapons and guerrilla strategies to unify the Muslim world against us. If anyone who doubts this has not read the reports coming from all segments of the Islamic world, for the majority believe that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were either masterminded by the CIA or by Massoud, the Israeli Secret Service. How might Jesus' teachings apply to the present situation? How might we, by following his example, have acted differently in the terrorist attacks? How might we still do so? The following are some nonviolent strategies we might have employed and still might employ. To begin with, we need to be less strident and belligerent in our rhetoric. Our continued bragging in the first months of the war that we were going to find Osama bin Laden and his cohorts and bring them to justice now makes us look rather silly. Our inflammatory rhetoric and braggadocio has strengthened the Muslim view of the United States as, quote, ruthless, aggressive, conceited, arrogant, easily provoked, and biased. We need to cultivate a spirit of humility, for not only does our prideful rhetoric inflame our enemies, it alienates our allies. A good example can be seen in the European reaction to Vice President Cheney's address to the Council on Foreign Relations last winter. Among other things, Cheney said, quote, America has friends and allies in this cause, but only we can lead it. Only we can rally the world in a task of this complexity and against an enemy so elusive and so resourceful. The United States, and only the United States, can see this effort through to victory. We are in a unique position because of our unique assets, because of the character of our people, the strength of our ideas, the might of our military, and the enormous economy that supports it. Chris Patton, the chief of the European Union's External Affairs Department, called such language reckless, even dangerous. As Shakespeare says in Measure for Measure, it is excellent to have a giant's strength. It is tyrannous to use it like a giant. Second, we shouldn't dehumanize our enemies as we have done in this and past wars. Categorizing the Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters as evil, inhuman, and barbaric not only inflames their hatred of us, it makes it easier for us to treat them as less than human. Third, we should treat Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners humanely. Some of our tactics in taking and holding prisoners in Afghanistan, as reported in the international press, have violated accepted principles, international principles of conduct. Our refusal, until international pressure forced us to change our policy, to accord prisoners taken in Afghanistan the privileges guaranteed by the Geneva Conventions, was, to my mind, wrong. I do not apologize for the fact that as I have seen these prisoners hooded and chained hand and foot and living in iron cages, I have felt sympathy for them. Contrast our treatment of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners with that of Moroni's treatment of the Lamanite prisoners he took in the Book of Mormon battles. Moroni always referred to these prisoners who behaved toward him with murderous hatred as, quote, my brethren. Each time he defeated the Lamanite army, he took prisoners. Moroni offered them their freedom if they would surrender their arms and promise not to fight against the Nephites again. When he saw how frightened the Lamanite soldiers were when they were encircled by his men, Moroni, quote, commanded his men that they should stop shedding their blood. And he said to Zarahemla, the Lamanite captain, we do not desire to be men of blood. Later, Moroni says that he did not glory in the shedding of blood, but in doing good. How different this is from the recently expressed attitude of Vice President Cheney. The war against terror will not end in treaty. There will be no summit meeting, no negotiations with terrorists. This conflict can only end in their complete and utter destruction. Fourth, we should admit our mistakes and try to make generous restitution. This applies not only to the mistakes we are making in the present conflict, but historically as well. While we are not deliberately targeting civilians in this war, we did target them by the firestorm of bombs we unleashed on German cities during the Second World War, by the nuclear holocaust we created in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which President J. Reuben Clark called, quote, the crowning savagery of the war, and by the carpet bombing and napalming of the Vietnamese countryside. Were we to apologize for using such tactics in the past and vow never to use them again, I believe that it would give us a moral stature not only with our allies, but with our enemies as well. While we claim a higher moral ground than Al-Qaeda because we have not deliberately targeted civilians, it is nonetheless true that we have probably killed as many civilians in our attacks on Afghanistan as were killed in the terrorist attacks. There's some dispute about how many, but some estimates are as high as 3,000 or 3,500 civilian casualties. We will probably never know, but it's a lot. Whatever the number, it is likely that most Americans do not count these deaths as significant as those of our own citizens. Perhaps this is inevitable, and yet I believe it is wrong. My heart has broken dozens of times as I've read the profiles of those killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But it has broken no less as I've read the stories of those who have lost loved ones due to our bombing and other attacks in Afghanistan. Most recently, our bombs killed 48 people and wounded over 100, most of whom are women and children, at a wedding celebration near Khost. Fathers holding their dead children in their arms, husbands weeping over slain wives, wives and mothers lamenting the deaths of husbands and children. These hearts break as easily as ours, these deaths felt as deeply. As Wendell Berry asks, how many deaths of other people's children by bombing or starvation are we willing to accept that we may be free, affluent, and supposedly at peace? To that question I answer none. Please, no children. Don't kill any children for my benefit. Beyond changing our military strategy and tactics, I would like to suggest some other things that our government might do. Some of these suggestions are related to the perception that Muslims have of us, as reported in the Gallup poll taken in March among 10,000 Islamic people in various countries. Among other things, they felt that, quote, the West pays little attention to their situation, does not attempt to help these countries, and makes few attempts to communicate or create cross-cultural bridges. So what might we do? We might establish a peace and reconciliation policy in Afghanistan similar to that followed recently in South Africa. We might establish a program whereby American churches and synagogues enter into relationships with mosques and Islamic countries, and whereby mosques in America establish relationships with churches and synagogues in other countries. We might establish a program whereby American families adopt Muslim families in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Palestine, and other countries. These need be no more than attempts to share information about their families and their traditions, but it might hopefully include American families contributing materially to the improvement of their adopted families. Consider what the impact would be if a million American families committed to providing $100 worth of support annually to a family in an impoverished Islamic country. We might commit to a 5% reduction in arms production annually for the next 5 years, with a concomitant commitment to use that same money to establish self-sustaining programs for poor, especially Islamic countries. We might establish a federal Department of Peace with a cabinet-level Secretary of Peace and a National Commission on Nonviolence. And we might stop exporting arms to other countries, de-escalate the arms race, lobby for the World Trade Organization to levy penalties against every arms exporting nation. We are, by the way, the world's largest exporter of arms. And the tragedy of that is very often those arms come back to kill our own people, as is happening with some of the warlords in Afghanistan. We might take a more balanced position in relation to the conflict between Palestine and Israel. Perhaps more than any single policy, our stance providing massive military, political, economic, and perhaps especially moral support for Israel has increasingly radicalized Muslims in the Middle East and throughout the world. We should express the same degree of outrage when Israeli reprisals in Palestine kill innocent civilians as we do when Palestine suicide bombers kill innocent Israelis. If you want to look at this, just look at the official response to the shelling in Pakistan recently that killed a number of women and children, then took out a member of Hamas, and the response to the suicide bombings that killed a number of people at the university in Jerusalem, including five Americans. The response, the official response, was dramatic. Finally, I would like to say something about Jesus' teachings about war and what I believe they tell us about what our attitude towards war should be. To begin with, Christ was against violent solutions. As Isaiah said of him, he has done no violence. He spelled out clearly the consequences of violence. All they that take the sword shall perish by the sword. The history of the world, including our own 200-year history, confirms this maxim. Thousands of years of human conflict have proved again and again that violence always begets violence. As Michael Nagler has observed, nonviolence sometimes achieves the success that was immediately aimed at, just as violence sometimes does. On the other hand, nonviolence always does what violence can never do. It brings into play forces that will bring about, sometimes invisibly, a better solution for all concerned. In the end, nonviolent means always bring about nonviolent ends. This was certainly true of Jesus' life and his daily gifts of mercy, in the acts he performed during his final week in mortality, and in his ultimate act of redemption in Gethsemane and Calvary. The Savior loved those who rejected and mocked him, who betrayed him, who spoke false witness against him, who spat upon and beat him, who drove nails into his hands and feet. What he wrought by his nonviolent response to violent attacks against him was the greatest redemptive act in the history of the world, and the potential salvation of humankind and greater personal peace in the world. Second, he invites us to participate in our own and others' redemption by committing to nonviolence. He asks us to love our enemies and to do good to those who despitefully use us, to return good for evil. Isaiah foresaw a time when people shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Suggesting that the Israelites might have power to help make such a day come, the Lord pleads, O house of Jacob, come ye and let us walk in the light of the Lord. While some see such a time as happening only during the millennium, modern revelations suggest otherwise, and I think this is very important. In fact, in a revelation given to the prophet Joseph Smith on the 7th of March, 1836, the Lord indicates that the Latter-day Saints are to establish, quote, a land of peace, a city of refuge, a place of safety for the saints of the Most High God. In the last days, this will be the only place on the earth for those committed to nonviolence, those who, quote, will not take up sword against his neighbor, can flee to safety. For these will be, quote, the only people that shall not be at war one with another. Imagine the implications of that. Further, the Lord suggests that this peaceful, nonviolent people will have a power much greater than arms and warfare. For the wicked will say, let us not go up to battle against Zion, for the inhabitants of Zion are terrible, wherefore we cannot stand. I contend that this part of our stewardship as Latter-day Saints, that this is part of our stewardship as Latter-day Saints, as the children of God. I hope no one is offended if I suggest that the current attitudes of many, perhaps most Latter-day Saints, will have to undergo a radical change before we can establish such a peaceful place of refuge. The fact that Utah has one of the highest per capita ownership of guns in the nation, and among the most permissive gun laws, including permission to carry guns to schools and to school campuses and to churches, suggests that we may not yet have caught the vision of this peaceful, nonviolent land we are called to establish. Each year in America, 10 times the number of people who died in the World Trade Center are killed with guns. Each year in America, 10 times those killed in the World Trade Center. As one minister commented in a recent murder, after a recent savage murder, we have become terrorists to our own people. What are the promises from the Lord to those who make peace? To begin with, they are promised that they will become the children of God. I don't believe that violence strengthens that filial relationship. Second, we are promised that we will enjoy the companionship of the Lord. As Paul promises, live in peace, and the God of love and peace shall be with you. Third, we are told that our righteousness will grow as we seek to be peaceful. As James said, righteousness is sown in peace to them that make peace. Fourth, our feet, like those who publish peace, will be beautiful upon the mountain. Finally, we are promised that only by following the Prince of Peace will we be able to see God. As Paul said to the Hebrews, follow peace, without which no man shall see the Lord. My father witnessed some of the most devastating destruction of the Second World War when he was a sailor in the South Pacific. He once described to me the scenes of horror he saw on Iwo Jima and the fear he felt as a kamikaze pilot aimed his plane at my father's ship only to change his mind at the last moment and dive into a larger ship and destroy it. My father bore the physical and psychical wounds of that war to his grave. It has been one of the great blessings of my life that I have been spared going to war. It has been more than a double blessing that my sons have not had to take up arms. Among other reasons, I am interested in our finding a better nonviolent strategy than the present one we have, because I do not want to see my 5 grandsons or any of their generation go to war. That's why, among other reasons, I am committed to pursuing peace and renouncing war. I firmly believe that if we were to undertake a nonviolent, spiritually transformative approach in combating terrorism, we would be more successful, we would reach our goal more quickly, and it would cost fewer lives than our present policy. Were we to truly follow the principles taught by the Prince of Peace, we might, in addition to transforming our enemies, or at least persuading them that there are nonviolent solutions to resolving their grievances, show them a better way to live in the world. The irony is that unless we do this, we compound our own suffering and we add to the suffering of him who suffered all for us. For his present suffering is increased as the evil and suffering in the world multiply. Ultimately, his way will prevail. Wouldn't it be a wonderful gift to him if we caused it to prevail now without the cost of violence?
Okay, thank you, Robert Reese. Again, my name is Brian Richards, and I'm the respondent. I must say that I'm very content with taking an alternative perspective. So let me support some of those statements that Robert has made with some of my experiences, especially some of the conversations that I've had recently. One of them is about the global war on terrorism. I noticed that some of the alternative perspectives and writings are challenging the war on terrorism. For one statement is that it is a criminal act, that it wasn't another nation that attacked us, but it was Al-Qaeda, a group of people that really don't represent another country. Now, of course, Afghanistan was supporting that and the Taliban, so it would be a war specifically on the Taliban, on Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda. But to have a global war on terrorism, perhaps this was a politically strong position to take, because at first we really didn't know who our enemy was. But now that we can articulate who that is, should we not go ahead and define the war more specifically rather than have this global war on terrorism? The reason why I state that personally is because when I studied over in Jerusalem and the Middle East, let's say I gained a sense of sympathy for the Palestinians and the occupation that they live in. This global war on terrorism certainly includes them, because they have many political groups that support terrorism against the occupation. Very few of these groups are direct enemies of the United States. It's certainly Hamas would be arguably against the U.S., but there are other groups that are not. And that brings us to the fact that Al-Qaeda really comes out of Saudi Arabia, and they were trying to capitalize on the political instability in Saudi Arabia by the differing families that are in power, these Machiavellian families that are struggling in Saudi Arabia for political power through either relationships with the U.S. or through Islamic fundamentalists. This is the real conflict. And in fact, they've tried to use the political credit built up by the Palestinians to further their cause in Saudi Arabia. So, again, if we were more articulate on who we were actually fighting the war with, perhaps we wouldn't be dragged into the quagmire between the Palestinians and the Israelis. When watching Al Jazeera over in the Middle East recently, the content was mostly on the Palestinian occupation. In other words, that is the weak link in our foreign policy, and that has caused...
Pardon me?
Excuse me, the Israeli occupation. Thank you, Robert. Certainly that is the weak link in our foreign policy, so therefore I really believe that we need to become more articulate in that. In my book, Triopian, The Burden of Excess, I explore the deeper conflict that's going on between the Middle East and the Western economies, especially the U.S. One of these conflicts is the religious state versus a modern nation. And I don't want to just say Islamic states, but it's the traditional way of life. We have, let's say, factions within our own political government that represent the Al-Qaeda perspective. And that is having religious states here, even in the U.S. Ironically, some of the most far radical right groups are the most condemning of Al-Qaeda, and they take such an extreme. I find that very paradoxical. But again, I believe that the deeper conflict is this religious state, and really, that is the deeper conflict that we're engaged with at this time, is this yearning of traditional culture in the Middle East to maintain their culture, their intimacy, and their desire to modernize. It's not just a conflict between the West and the Middle East. They're having the conflict internally. Sometimes I've heard the statement, the natural state of man is war. I think Hitler said that. I don't know where it came from originally. Where did it come from originally, Glenn? You should know. Yes. It came from Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes is the man who originally said the natural state of man is war. We can look at this in a positive way. In some ways, freedom embraces that chaos. And we have that here in this country. When you allow people to have freedom, the creativity and the productivity that grows from that is exciting. And like I've said before, for the past 300 years, Western economies have simply outperformed these Islamic states, these Islamic religious states, where freedom has not been as available. There's a book that was written by a Russian author that said the future wars are going to be about religions, not states. And I think that that's very possible. But if that's true, we're going to go back to that medieval Europe. You know, you think about the Three Musketeers. It's a simple plot. The state and the religious state in conflict. How many have seen the Three Musketeers in here? Okay, you understand the plot, what I'm talking about. And that is the cardinal pitted against the king, more or less the secular king, which in many ways represents a modern nation and a secular democracy. And sometimes we can have the most religious freedom by having a secular democracy. When you have a religious state, you have, paradoxically, less religious freedom. So again, that's where I feel that the deeper conflict is happening. And that relates to my writing, and I believe it also supports Robert's statement about this broad sweeping war on terrorism. terrorism, a need to, let's say, be more articulate in what we are actually fighting against. Thank you very much.
We're going to have some time for questions. What I'd like you to do is, if you have a question, say first who it's addressed to, and then if that person would come up and you ask your question, and then one of you, whoever it's to, would you restate the question into the microphone?
As you're thinking, coming about your question, it occurred to me that Yeats has a poem called Among School Children, in which he asks this question: what mother, if she had on her lap, instead of her infant child, the 100-year-old man that he would become, would think that it was worth the pangs of childbirth to bring this person, child, into the world? And I was thinking Abraham, how Abraham, if Abraham had seen when he had this great blessing that he would be the father of nations, if Abraham could have seen his children killing each other with such vengeance and violence today, how would Abraham have felt about that blessing? Questions? Please come up.
My question is for, is it Robert? Bob. I feel like your want is noble, but I feel it's quite unrealistic. I feel if we had taken a nice, peaceful approach to Japan and Germany, we'd probably currently be speaking Japanese or German, whereas instead we invaded and bombed Japan, and in 57 years we've had absolutely no problem with them.
This, by the way, is the classical argument against nonviolent direct action. I think it's important in both of those wars to back up a bit to see what was happening with our embargoing oil in Japan, and that caused Japan to come into the war. We were not innocent bystanders in that conflict. And if you look what happened at the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War, they put Germany in such a straitjacket. Anyone could have predicted that. But, you know, the people always say, well, yeah, but what about the Nazis? The interesting thing is that there were some nonviolent direct actions against the Nazis that worked. I'll give you an example of one. When the Nazis were rounding up the non-Aryan spouses of Germans, that Germans who had married Jews, and were getting ready to deport them, large numbers of them, 10,000 family members marched against the government and against the Gestapo, and they changed their tactics and they didn't deport those people. There are other examples in which that did work. The question is, yes, it is. One can say it's idealistic. One can say it's not realistic. But the fact of the matter is, in the history of the world, we haven't given it really much of a chance. We are so quick to go to violent measures, and we don't know, for example, what would happen in terms of the present conflict, as it's called, the war in Afghanistan, the war on terrorism. Again, we are not completely innocent of the causes of that conflict. We bear some responsibility, and if we were to acknowledge that responsibility, if we were in fact to try and make peace, if we were to try to negotiate, there are some people that you may not be able to negotiate with. The price of taking a nonviolent direct approach is that you sometimes have to pay the price, as the anti-Nehi Nephites did with their passive nonviolent approach. But the fact that it is that we scarcely give it a chance. And let's say that even in the present circumstance, we want to say we should have bombed Afghanistan. At what point do we start trying to make peace? Or do we just ultimately, you know, do the classic Jaredite thing, sword in hand until we all kill each other down to the last two people who kill each other? I think that it is, in some ways it's unrealistic, some ways it's idealistic, but I, for one, happen to believe that Jesus was speaking seriously and not with a forked tongue when he spoke that. Yes, Francis.
would both of you please muse a little bit about why you think the Christian right is so associated with going forward dramatically militarily? And if you hear any apocalyptic kinds of overtones in the rhetoric, Christian apocalypse.
Well, it's very interesting. If you go back, say, to 1996, 97, and 98 and read the books that were coming out about what was going to happen with the turning into a new millennium, most of them said what Ryan has said, that the conflicts in the 21st century will be conflicts of religious fundamentalism. Karen Armstrong, in her book on fundamentalism, makes a case for this, and you see it with the Muslims and the Hindus in India. You see it throughout with Christians and Jews and Muslims. And the question, if I understood it, is why do you see this association? Clearly, I think we do, and one of the strangest things in America is that a religious group that has been essentially anti-Semitic for hundreds of years, which is the Christian fundamentalist right, has now become very pro-Israel, with, you know, because of some apocalyptic vision of the future that this is the place to be aligned. But there's no question that, and it, you know, it troubles me frankly about Mormon fundamentalism. I mean, the extent to which we are so, as a people, so aligned with a kind of right of center ideology, and there are lots of people around here who have, you know, weapons and things because they think we're going to be invaded, and their job is to help, you know, stop the invasion. So yeah, I think it clearly is there is a connection to that, whether it's among the Jews, among the Muslims, among the Christians. There is a clear alliance of war with the apocalyptic violent vision of the future.
I love this question. I've already answered it once. One time I said on the radio, I said, it's because the Christians have actually become literate. There was a time when there was a lot of bigotry towards the Jews, especially in medieval Europe. And that has totally reversed. And the reason why is because they're actually reading the Bible now. You take a look at the Old Testament and New Testament, it's about Israel from the beginning to end. And so now they're actually reading their own canonized doctrine and going, okay, we're on your side now. So there's also another reason why they're so adamant against for Israel. I believe it's a Cold War legacy. Keep in mind that 1948, when Israel expanded their borders, that was soon after World War II, the Cold War was in full swing. And now that the Cold War is over, many of our foreign policies are still in place, and the rhetoric is still in place from the Cold War. I'll give you an example of that. 1967 is a pivotal point. That's what the Saudi peace plan is all about. In other words, Israel, withdraw. Stop using the water. Stop using the airspace. Stop occupying the land. Get out of those pre-1967 borders. Israel doesn't have a lot of incentives to do that. Now, even on the Discovery Channel, just recently, I listened to a documentary on the history of this conflict. And just right out of the textbook, more or less, they talked about how there was a preemptive strike against the Arabs. Now, our own intelligence in the U.S. Indicated that the war would be over within a week. General Rabin indicated that the Egyptian president's name slipped my name. Not Saddam. Nasser. Nasser, he has indicated after that conflict that he knew Nasser did not want war because bringing only two divisions was not enough to start a war to the border. Secondly, he had divisions down in Yemen that were dealing with a civil war. And so to say that it was a preemptive strike, that war was inevitable, that their mere survival was hanging over them, is the same kind of propaganda that's actually being used today. And Egypt, there wasn't a great deal of strong evidence that Egypt was on the verge to attack in 1967. And yet Israel attacked them, killed 12,000 troops, destroyed 300 planes, and then went and turned on Jordan and Syria and expanded their borders greatly. And ever since, they have occupied that land. And so, are we going to take the Arabic perspective and say that they were attacked first in 1967? Or do we maintain this, let's say, Cold War rhetoric where the Egyptians are buying hardware from the Soviet Union, so they're on the bad side, and the Israelis are on our side, so we're going to overlook the facts? So those are the two reasons why I believe we have such a strong bias at this point.
It's a good question as to the extent to which our greed and our consumption drives these kinds of things. I think that it would be naive to think that our, at least part of our reason for being in Afghanistan is not connected to its strategic connection to oil, and as the reason for our overlooking all of the things that are happening in Saudi Arabia, which are really anti-American and that are terrorists. I think, obviously in this world we live in, there are tremendous complexities, but as human beings, if we can't respond to the humiliation, for example, that a Palestinian feels, a Palestinian who can't make a movement from one place to the next without going through a checkpoint, who can't buy food for a child, if we don't see them as children of Abraham, in the same way that we see the Jews as children, we see ourselves as children of Abraham, as we see all of ourselves as children of God, then we are, as W.H. Auden said at the beginning of the Second World War, we must love one another or die. And I think that's the choice that's before us, and it remains to be seen what we will do. But I think as Latter-day Saints, what this doctrine and covenant scripture says is that we have a spiritual and moral obligation to establish a land of peace. And I think that the Lord will hold us accountable if we don't do that. Thank you. Yes, one. Oh, we need to stop, but. One final word is I would like us all to remember that one of the most peaceful members of our community, Brother Eugene England, who worked and fought for peace for his whole life, is no longer with us. And let's carry on this fight for peace in his memory.